We're very pleased this morning. I'm Frank Verastro. I'm the director of the energy program here at CSIS. We're very pleased this morning to have with us Steve Levine, who's been working for a dozen years on a compilation of kind of the history of the development of the Caspian, Central Asia, the interplay between Russia and the United States, kind of the great game, which I know Rich and others don't like the definition that way. This was an extremely important time. Typically at CSIS, what we don't do is book launches, especially if they're non-CSIS publications. We made an exception here. And we made an exception here for a couple reasons. Between Bob, Ed, and I, we've all known Steve since, kind of the mid-1990s. We've seen his writing. We find it to be extremely balanced. He's insightful in his analysis, and it's a solid reporting. But that's only the first point. The second big piece is that we just thought that this story is just so extraordinary that it needs to be told. And there's a lot of lessons that we can draw from this and a lot of applicability for things that are going on today, some of which I feel personally has been missed or misunderstood or mischaracterized by some of the policy decisions we're making today. The third view, I think, is just the fact that on a personal basis, Ed and I, in our corporate lives, spent a chunk of time in this part of the world. Ed mostly in Kazakhstan and Russia, myself in Azerbaijan, Georgia, and a little bit in Turkey, working on pipeline projects and some of these negotiations that are actually documented in Steve's book. There are several people in this room as I look around, Michael, Rich, John, folks that worked on this as well. And this is a story that needs to be told in a broader perspective because it wasn't only government to government. It was the confluence of commercial interests, diplomatic interests, strategic interests at a time when the Soviet Union was coming apart, so Russia didn't have certainly the stroke that it has today. And you had these independent republics that had resource-rich areas that were looking for technology and alliance with the United States. So companies came in, projects were built. These were multi-billion dollar projects over a long period of time. And it was just an exceptional time. It was an exceptional time for me, for Ed. One of the things that we tend to do at CSIS here is that we like to stay in the background. So while this story is about Central Asia, and we're fairly certain that when the book comes out, that we'll be favorably treated in the book. Just the small role that we played in reorienting Central Asia and bringing democracy to the Caucasus, keeping Russia in its place and moving these projects forward, we're confident that this is something that'll be explained fully in the book. I would especially, though, like to point out, there was two folks, during my process, and I'll turn this over to Ed, when we were working in Azerbaijan, there was two individuals in the government. There was a bunch of folks, starting with Leon Firth and Charlie Curtis, Ambassador Morningstar, that moved this forward. But there was two in particular that saw out front where this was all going and helped us develop the strategy and bring the corporate interest and the government interest together. And those were Sheila Heslin at the National Security Council, who couldn't be with us today, but she said to give you all hugs and kisses, and that ain't going to happen. Big hug. And Ambassador Rich Kozlerich, who was at the State Department in Policy Planning. He was a Deputy Assistant Secretary, and he was the first ambassador in Azerbaijan. And he was just terrific, second ambassador. But he was most pivotal at the time that this was working to move these projects forward. So Ed, take off the glasses and move this forward.
I thought we were going to wear it the whole session. Well, Frank's given his reason why Steve got invited as an exception to the rule at CSIS. This book, as Steve said, has been more than 10 years in the making. Steve was arrived as a reporter in Russia just at the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union, as I recall. He has a very detailed presentation, which I told him to compress because he does really want people to buy his book. So there's no point in giving it all away for free. And most of all, because I think it would be useful to have a discussion with this very informed audience here. I've been answering questions from Steve from Moscow to Almaty. with a few other places in between. And so this will, after his presentation, will be our chance to ask him questions about for change. So Turnabout is fair play, and we'll be able to ask an ACE reporter who's been living and working in the region for a dozen years questions of what he has learned from both watching it close up, as well as having the last few years to step back and gain some perspective and looking at the broad sweep of this very large story. So without further ado, Steve, the floor is yours.
Thanks. This working? Everyone can hear me? Okay. It's so great to make this launch, to make the presentation right here at CSIS for the very reasons that Frank and Ed said. They must be delighted to get me out of their hair. I was at Ed's house, at his office, in his car, and Frank, well, you were very patient. Yeah. So Bob Ebel read the manuscript before it went to press, which doesn't mean he's responsible for what's inside. Sorry, Bob. Okay. I am compressing the talk. So bear with me with some. There are extraneous slides and that I'll jump through. Okay. I call this time of America on the Caspian Sea one of the signal American foreign policy triumphs of the last 10 years. And it all revolved around the pipeline morass, and specifically the construction of this pipeline, the Baku-Jehan pipeline, 1,000 miles linking the Caspian and the Mediterranean Sea. The time it took, and the battles that took place to make this pipeline happen, make up a large part of the book. And you can look at it as America's victory in the first battle of an energy war. And I argue that America won the first battle when this pipeline came online a year ago and started delivering 1 million barrels a day to the Mediterranean Sea. But I also say that America is currently losing the second battle. And the second battle is America, in a way, is fighting the old war. America is focusing in Europe on installing anti-missile devices in the Czech Republic and in Poland. Russia is building pipelines. Russia is building natural gas pipelines primarily, but also oil pipelines, and I'll get to that later in the talk. I'm going to breeze through old Baku, although that's what made the region. Ludwig Nobel, the first oil tanker, Henry Mason Day. When Bill Clinton, I'm sorry, because of the camera, right? Okay. When Bill Clinton became president, he brought along with him to the White House an old buddy from his Oxford days, Strobe Talbot. Strobe Talbot became Clinton's expert, the spearhead of policy in Russia and the whole Soviet Union. Talbot had a romantic view of Russia and of the Soviet Union. It was based in his past, where he came from, the translator of the Khrushchev memoirs and his long reading of the literature and understanding of the culture. And this carried over and overlapped with Talbot's policy on Russia. Since Talbot was a friend of Bill's,
his understanding and Talbot's views on Russia trumped everybody's, except of course Clinton's. And that view was a denial of the great game. Excuse me, Rich. The people who surrounded Talbot actually struck the term "great game" from some documents that crossed their desk, with the idea somehow that this would remove the idea, this undeniable competition that was going on from the canvas. The way events transpired after this in the mid-90s forced Talbot to change his mind and forced him to change American policy on the Caspian and forced the United States to challenge Russia. The way this happened was through the formation underneath him of a critical mass of opinion contrary to his own regarding Russia, the Russia First policy being that we are primarily concerned, for example, with arms control. We can't allow there to be any policy that in any way interferes with that ultimate goal. The contrary opinion held that Russia was a dangerous and a threatening power. And this view was founded in events in Central Asia and the Caucasus. And the place where this sprang from were junior officers like Sheila Heslin in the State Department, in the Energy Department, on the National Security Council. Heslin believed that Russia held in Central Asia and the Caucasus an iron umbilical cord. Iron umbilical cord. This was a term she coined. She coined it in a paper she wrote. This was the idea that Central Asia and the Caucasus, all the oil and the natural gas that could be exported from the region had to pass through Russia. Heslin said that as long as Russia had this and exercised this iron umbilical cord, these states would never be independent, and that the United States should get behind them. The turning point in this conflict of ideas within the administration was a meeting. It was in 1996. It was in Washington, and it consisted of the deputy secretaries of all these departments, including Strobe Talbot and Sheila Heslin. And what Sheila did was she took a blank piece of paper and she drew on it Central Asia and the Caucasus. And what you could see when you looked at it was that surrounding the whole region, Iran to the south, China to the east, and Russia to the north, were countries of primary American strategic interest. Heslin argued that this region was bound to become a battleground for influence among all of these states, and that the United States needed to join that battle and win it. Talbot could not argue with that logic. Nobody could argue with that logic. And so was born American policy supporting the region and the construction of the Baku-Jehan pipeline, right there, which came online a year ago, right in the nick of time. It was it coincided with Russia's reemergence on the world stage as an assertive power, attempting to use its influence in questions all around the world. It won't surprise anybody that Russia, however, has proven itself, despite the construction of this pipeline, as a consummate player of pipeline politics. And it's done so primarily through its actions on the east side of the Caspian. And one illustration of this is its action with the Tengiz oil field and the construction of and the attempted expansion of this pipeline. It's a dedicated 1,000-mile pipeline leading from Tengiz across Kazakhstan and Russia to the Black Sea right here. Chevron thought, when it acquired a 50% share in the Tengiz field, that it was going to be able to fairly rapidly get a pipeline going. What unfolded instead has been a 15-year travail. And just as an illustration of how this has taken place is a meeting a few years back involving all of the players who put this pipeline together. And it was in Almaty, and it involved the energy ministers of Russia, Kazakhstan, Oman, and a couple of privateers who appear in my book, who Ed Chow really loves, John Doyce and James Giffen. At this meeting, okay. At this meeting, Yuri Shafranik, the Russian energy minister, was becoming angrier and angrier at the Kazakh side, because the Kazakhs were intractable on Russian demands in terms of, at this point, of forming the pipeline. And at one point, Shafranik says to Nurlan Bogambayev, the Kazakh energy minister, "Nurlan, do you mind? Can I borrow your mobile phone?" And he takes the phone and disappears into the corner and has a muffled conversation, and returns to the table. And not long later, the meeting breaks up for the day. When the Kazakhs went back to their office, they discovered what that phone call was all about. And there was, on top of the fax machine, an announcement from Russia: "Freak storm on the Black Sea. All oil shipments suspended for further notice." What is this all about? This is a message: don't mess with Russia. The pipeline eventually was built. It's currently shipping 650,000 barrels a day, a little over half of which comes from the Tengiz field. But Chevron's economic model has called for 1 million barrels a day to be shipped through that pipeline, and it is proposing a doubling of the size of the pipeline to 1.4 million barrels a day. Not surprisingly, Russia is blocking this expansion. An oil man in Kazakhstan, in terms of anticipating what Russia is all about, how do you go about figuring what's going to happen, told me, generally, when someone's holding a knife to your throat, he wants something. What does Russia want? Russia wants Chevron to pay for the construction of another pipeline, a completely, almost completely disconnected pipeline that would go from Bulgaria to Greece. Chevron is resisting this so far, but the pipeline actually makes logical sense. The logic being that most Russian oil, needs to travel through the Bosphorus Strait, right here, through the center of Istanbul, and this is an ecological danger. By building a pipeline like that, this would be 1 million barrels a day of oil that would not have to go through the Bosphorus. But the pipeline also has commercial logic for Russia, because it means that Baku-Jehan is not the only game in town in terms of putting Caspian oil onto the Mediterranean Sea. And It has geopolitical logic because this pipeline is just one of a whole series of mostly natural gas but also oil pipelines that Russia has on the drawing board, all of which amount to, when you look at them, and this is what I'm going to explain, how the great game is currently being played and how the United States is missing out on it and how Russia is well advanced. This is one pipeline. Russia is also proposing and has gotten approval for, but these approvals don't really amount to anything. You've really got to wait until there's until they've actually ordered the steel and have it delivered to know that a deal is really hard. But that said, a deal has been signed to transport Turkmenistan natural gas and Kazakhstan natural gas into Russia, all of their natural gas. The consequence of which would be to isolate the Eastern Caspian from the rest of the world. It already is isolated, but this would isolate them without any relief in sight. Russia wants to take that natural gas, combine it with its own, and ship it through Nord Stream, a second natural gas pipeline that would feed Northern Europe, and South Stream, feeding that natural gas into Southern Europe. In addition to the consequences of these pipelines in terms of the Eastern Caspian, there's a consequence for Europe. There's a debate going on right now in Europe. Does it matter that Russia already supplies 30% of Europe's natural gas and oil? Does it matter that Russia is buying up energy installations in Central Europe, in Eastern Europe, and on into Western Europe? I personally don't think this is much of a debate. Germany, for example, has an almost shocking closeness to Russia on the energy question. In what other country in the world does a former head of state become an employee of the energy company of another country? Gerhard Schroeder is an employee of Gazprom. He's in charge of that Nord Stream pipeline. Italy, Eni has made a deal to sell its retail network to Gazprom in exchange for access to natural gas fields in Russia. Italy and Germany are being imprudent in this sense. Russia is not Norway. Russia has political and economic ambitions, and by getting so close to Russia and increasing Russia's dominance, energy dominance, petropower projected into Europe, it's creating a treacherous battleground for Europe and by extension for the United States. I'm going to close with a look at an answer to this, a way of shaving some off of this, of getting into the game. And it is something going on right now, and it is another pipeline. The Trans-Caspian pipeline, this right here, really, natural gas pipeline. It has been proposed for a long time. It was proposed first in the mid-1990s, but it was put on the back burner because the then president of Turkmenistan was demanding a $500 million bribe to make that happen. But he's dead now. And there's a chance that the new president would allow this to go forward. This would be I have no idea why these pipelines are always 1,000 miles, but this one also is 1,000. $5 billion is the price tag. And it would carry Turkmen natural gas and perhaps Kazakh natural gas from Central Asia on into Europe, and from there be shipped to Europe. This would accomplish two things. It would give Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan a role. They would become a unit with the Caucasus in terms of being able to have an independent energy channel to the West. It would provide them some, by extension, political independence. And for Europe, it would give Europe a more diversified energy supply. And the ultimate achievement of this would be to take that knife and pull it just a few inches away from that throat. Thank you very much.
I told Steve to expect lots of tough questions from a very well-informed policy crowd in Washington. And if you don't come up with some, I'm going to come up with
a few of my own. I saw you furiously scribbling.
Yes. Since we are recording this session, please speak into the mic. And if you're not at the table, get close to a mic. Do we have any mics around? If you could speak into the mic and identify yourself and the organization you're from, we would appreciate it. With that, the floor is open. Just push the button.
Okay. Ken Austin, I'm with the Treasury Department. One thing you didn't raise, I understand that a pipeline to China would be substantially longer, but on the other hand, China could take everything that comes out of the Caspian in the future and probably still need some more. Why has that alternative? I mean, going directly from Kazakhstan into China, all the political issues are taken care of, all the rights of way. Why have you not spoken about that? Is it just totally economically unfeasible, even with the Chinese subsidizing everything they can get?
Okay, good, very good question. Ed made me shorten my talk.
I'd never told you to cut out China.
This is exactly right. China, in fact, is in effect a passive ally for the West. If in fact Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, and China did build these oil and natural gas pipelines that are proposed, this would almost accomplish, because then you've got two buyers. Is this right? Duopoly, yeah. So, but why is China? You know, I'll ask you a question. Why is China so slow about making this happen? The pipeline from Kazakhstan, for example, the oil pipeline, it was proposed in 1997. It's still not finished. Why is it only 200,000 barrels a day? And this other natural gas pipeline proposed from Turkmenistan, $26 billion. Is this going to be built? I really have my doubts. There are ways this could happen. I don't know why China is being so slow, but the spirit behind the question you raise, I think, is spot on.
Jonathan Elkind, Eastlink Consulting and Brookings Institution. Steve, first of all, very good to see you, and I look forward to reading the book. A comment and a question. The comment is that I'm a little bit surprised at the strength of your choice of wording, even as somebody who was very much a partisan in this in my time in government. Nonetheless, the labeling of it of these developments as a victory per se, and I'd like to hear more comments on in what regard, you know, what the victory consists of. My question is maybe a reformulation of that. My question is, okay, so what are the key lessons that one should be drawing at this time out of the experience in the 1990s, and given the the dynamics that you were speaking about at the end, what are the lessons for companies and for governments in terms of how to formulate strategy and what the strategy should be and how they should pursue it?
Do you have 2 hours? First, what is the victory? The victory is that, in one sentence, the Russian monopoly on oil exports from this is a form of the economic lifeline from the Caucasus is broken. The monopoly is broken, and this is an achievement that cannot be overstated. At once, Russia's leverage in that region is shrunk. Now we can argue about how much it's shrunk, but also Russia at once also seems less invincible in that region as well. What are the lessons of that? One is that this pipeline was fought over tooth and nail. American academic institutions, European governments, other oil companies, almost all the oil companies, apart from Frank's probably, fought the construction of that pipeline, but the one or two of the oil companies and the government, the U.S. government, stuck with it, and eventually BP, for commercial reasons, found that it would back that pipeline, namely because it wanted a clear road to buy ARCO. It wanted American approval for that. That lesson is I hate to put it this way, but it is because of the current context, but it demonstrates that the United States can be preemptive and can be unipolar in some select cases, have an undeniable triumph with long-term meaning and a long-term future and a base for future victories. How's it being played now? Where should this go? The way it should go is that the U.S. should go on to the next stage of the pipeline game and realize that the future of power in Europe on the continent will include who controls the pipelines and the energy infrastructure. And Russia realizes that and is playing it, and the United States is kind of playing it, but it's not playing it well. It's kind of playing it with this Nabucco pipeline. But as your smirk validly implies, it's not quite credible yet.
I know Lou has a question. I'm going to get to him next. But before I do that, I want to identify one of the other retired pipeline players in the game. Ambassador Bill Courtney, who just walked into the room, was instrumental in helping Chevron with the CPC pipeline construction. But let me also follow up a little bit on John's question. It seems to me that in a way, Russia and we are playing completely different games. I mean, for a country like Russia, pipelines are about control and are about politics, and they are willing to subsidize suboptimal economic projects in order to maintain control. We don't do that as a country and as a government. We don't subsidize projects. So part of the challenge is how do you align commercial interests by companies and primarily American companies, partly because, as you pointed out, the European national champions all have other interests business interests in Russia that they're pursuing. How do you align commercial interests with government's interests in order to operationalize a policy? I mean, what worked in the 90s, partly because Russia was weak, and countries like Iran were weak, and partly because of a lower price of oil, at $80 oil, the same strategy, tools, and so on may not work, that worked in the 90s may not work this time around. So how do we do that in a policy sense of if we are going to pursue a more active policy in this area? How does one do that? Do you have any ideas on that, Steve?
Yeah, I do. This is a very good question. In my view, the key reason Baku Jayan worked was Heydar Aliyev. It was not the United States, and it was not BP. You had a super brilliant, forward-thinking, and courageous analyst. We're not talking about the human rights. We'll leave that later. Okay, but in terms of just being a tough player who knew how to play the game with the Kremlin and the willingness to put his life on the line and his partner, Edward Shevardnadze, in the same game, that's why the pipeline worked. They first committed to it, and then the United States got behind them. Nursultan Nazarbayev is not Heydar Aliyev. I don't understand Nazarbayev. I don't understand why he is so cautious on this question, but he is. There is a chance that Berdimuhamedov, Niyazov's successor in Turkmenistan, could stand up and commit and take the heat. I don't say that he will, but if there is a solution, a first step that needs to happen for the U.S. to get into the game, Berdimuhamedov needs to step up to the plate and say, I'm with you. I'm going to do it. And then the U.S. can get behind him with these. You know, it's not exactly true that the U.S. doesn't subsidize. We just do it in a different way. Ex-Im banking, the EBRD, discussions with various banks to make sure that they want to put money behind these lines. If the Trans-Caspian pipeline were born and there were throughput commitments, then Nabucco would suddenly become more viable than it is.
Lou Pellerisi, Energy Policy Research Foundation. First, you know, I think you can get trapped in taking it farther than you might want to. And first, if you look at the gas prices, first on Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan, the recent gas deals with the Russians are very modest, and that's not a massive pipeline. And in fact, the price Russians are paying for gas now barely covers their shipping costs to Ukraine. In other words, by the time they buy the gas and ship to Ukraine, I suspect the margin for Gazprom is zero or close to negative. And if you look at Stern's work, and you think about the European gas market, which is very fragmented, which is very untransparent, it's not unusual for Gazprom. If you think about Gazprom as a commercial entity, and this is where I have a little analysis. For example, Ukraine is a classic because they can't own the pipelines, which they want to do. But for Gazprom, reliability as well. The pipelines are in desperate need of repair, but they can't make the investment because they don't own the asset. So the question is, in many ways, you can view the alternative, Nord Stream, South Stream, as kind of expensive alternatives to ensure reliability to Europe. In fact, if you look at Stern's work and you see what's been happening, in terms of the sort of poisoning of the relationship between the Europeans and the Russians, there's a good chance that Gazprom will not be providing more gas to Europe than it is now as a percentage of their total requirements.
It is true that Gazprom has commercial logic behind its strategy. The construction of Nord Stream to avoid Belarus and to avoid Ukraine and so not to have interruptions. But the motive behind the pipeline doesn't change the outcome of the pipeline's existing. It doesn't matter if why Russia is building this line from Turkmenistan onto Kazakhstan so now it's willing to pay $100 or $130 and sell it currently for $260. I don't know what their shipping costs really are, and I'm not familiar with the numbers that you're quoting that they really do eat up all this $130 in profit in the transportation going on to Europe.
The price of Ukraine is not that
high. Right. Right, but when they sell on, but when they, yeah, when they sell on, yeah, yeah. So, just sort of to wrap that up, the one mustn't get lost in the motives of a player, meaning Russia, in terms of analyzing the outcome and the I believe that Russia having and continuing to have and perhaps building on its petrol power in Europe does have an impact in influencing Europe not in terms of Europe is not going to suffer a cut off of energy the way that Belarus has and Ukraine has. I don't believe Russia will play that game, but it will use this petropower to influence Europe's decisions in political questions that the United States cares about.
Rich Kostlerich, former U.S. ambassador to Azerbaijan. A couple of things I think you said were important and maybe bear a little elaboration. I guess I sort of agree with John how to characterize what happened there as a victory. If I were to put my finger on a victory, it would be less the pipeline than the actual signing of the contract of the century. Because I think that was, if you want to, however you want to characterize Heydar Aliyev's actions, but by doing that, that was a clear signal that he was breaking with kind of the assumed relationships in the energy sector that were left over from the Soviet Union, going to strike out in a different direction. Wasn't entirely clear where it was going to be, but I really think, mainly because I was there then and wasn't there when they turned the spigot on for Baku, Tbilisi, Ceyhan, that to me was a more seminal event. And the interesting thing was the role of the Russians. The Russians took themselves out of the game at the beginning by a conscious decision, literally within weeks of the signing of the contract of the century, to drop this diplomatic note in New York that essentially said the Caspian Sea jurisdiction is unclear. We believe it's governed by Russian, Soviet, Iranian agreements. Therefore, anybody who invests in the Caspian is doing so at their own risk. They took themselves out of the game, and they never recovered from that, at least as far as Azerbaijan was concerned. Bill can talk about Kazakhstan. Second point, I think what was important was the relationship that developed between the U.S. government and the energy companies. And this wasn't a case, in my humble opinion, of either side being in the pocket of the other, but there was an alignment of commercial interests, which we recognized on the ground in Azerbaijan were quite different, even among American companies, and the U.S. government's desire to help support the independence, territorial integrity of Azerbaijan. And, you know, every week I would have a meeting in my office of representatives of all the oil companies, not just American, but the others, so that I was always constantly understanding where the companies were coming from. And that was happening elsewhere as well. And I thought, you know, again, if there's a success, it was the success of that relationship, because we did have this understanding. And I think sort of as this thing moved ahead, development of the resource and ultimately the pipeline, it was because that relationship, that foundation was already in place. Last thing, it was easy for me because we were only thinking about oil. One of the biggest disappointments during my time there was when BP found gas. We thought, shoot, you know, Frank promised me there was more oil.
Still is. Still looking.
But it's a different, you know, it's a different game, I think. I mean, I'm not an oil expert, but I think when you start, you know, looking at gas and pipelines and all of this, it becomes more complicated. Anyway.
Bill, you want to contribute on the Kazakhstan perspective?
Oh, sure. Thanks. Just a couple of things about Kazakhstani and Nazarbayev motives. One, Kazakhstan had, at the time of independence, 40% of its people were ethnic Russians. It had a very delicate balancing act, much more delicate than the Caucasus countries had. Nazarbayev, you'll recall, had been invited by Gorbachev to be Deputy Secretary General of the Communist Party just before it collapsed, and wisely turned it down, but it was a sign of how careful he was in working with Moscow. Because Kazakhstan was so large, so exposed, Kazakhstan, in many respects, was a giant military test range for the former Soviet Union. So they had so much Russian military presence. They were just extremely careful not to do anything to go out of their way. The Soviet incursion into Abkhazia was a useful reminder to Kazakhstan, which was more exposed, if you will, to Russia even than Georgia, of what could happen. And it didn't happen. And that was actually part of the genius of the way Kazakhstan managed its independence. A second motivation was the Caspian Pipeline Consortium. With Tengiz coming first, before the deal of the century, so to speak, the Kazakhstanis and Chevron signed the deal for Tengiz, but did not work out the shipping arrangements. That was left to be worked out. Russia, Kazakhstan, and untrustworthy oil trader in Oman named John Deutsch tried to work out an arrangement which was uneconomical, unfinanceable, and lots of people worked to encourage Kazakhstan to move away from that, which they finally did only after Georgia and Azerbaijan signed the arrangement for the little pipeline over to Poti, and within a month after that, than the corrupt Caspian Pipeline Consortium arrangement that Deutsch and others had tried to foist on Kazakhstan collapsed and a more economic arrangement worked out. So Kazakhstan, in addition to having the ethnic Russian concern, had the concern about getting the Caspian Pipeline Consortium working through Russia, which would give Russia some permanent leverage. So I think on both counts, that caused Kazakhstan to be more cautious with regard to Baku, Ceyhan. They didn't feel they needed to take quite the leading position on that that Azerbaijan and others did.
It seems to me we've identified a couple of keys from the past that may be important lessons for the future. One is, Steve already talked about, a strong regional leader that has a vision as to how he's going to achieve his policy, including more independence than he had before. The second is this alignment between government and commercial interests. I mean, in the case of both CPC and BTC, it was pretty clear who the commercial champion was going to be. For the projects that we're looking on to the future, it's much harder to identify a single commercial champion along the lines that the role that Chevron played on CPC and the role that BP played ultimately on BTC.
Bob Ebel from CSIS. 60 years ago, I was a member of the first U.S. all delegation to the Soviet Union. And now 60 years later, after visiting the Baku, we're sitting around the table talking about a pipeline from Baku to Ceyhan. History hadn't changed that much. But let me raise a question about the Trans-Caspian pipeline. It's my understanding that for a pipeline to be built across the Caspian Sea requires the approval of all five states bordering on the Caspian Sea. And how can you ever get permission from Russia and Iran for approval to build that pipeline?
Thanks, Bob. This is the Russian position that this pipeline can't be built. Russia also threatened to this note, this diplomatic note. We have a veto over any activity going on the Caspian Sea, on the offshore Baku, offshore Kazakhstan. The oil companies decided to defy this proclaimed veto. This is, I'm forgetting who raised this question, but the idea, I think, that Russia is no longer so weak and Putin is not Yeltsin. This is a main question. But I think that that technically it's arguable that you need all the countries' approval. But when Nazarbayev came out of the Tehran conference a few days ago, he said, no, all you need is permission of the two countries whose waters through whom it passes. And I think that's the valid analysis. And I think that that's what he was saying. And just to push this a little bit further, just as a blueprint for how this could happen, taking into account Nazarbayev's caution, if Berdimuhamedov stands up and agrees to build that pipeline, Nazarbayev suddenly has political cover. What can I do? Berdimuhamedov is building this. I might as well use that pipeline too, and suddenly you have both countries using it.
Yes, Dr. Sam Hancock of Green Motion and the Eurasia Center. Thank you, Steve, for being here and sharing this very sound information with us. But in what concrete steps do you think the United States and the commercial interest should move forward? We have this insistence on the missile shield in Eastern Europe. You say the United States has kind of backed off its strategic role in future pipelines. What do you think should be the next steps, both for the government and the American commercial interest, to move the move this whole matter forward at this time?
Yeah, I don't think that the United States has backed off. It just simply hasn't gotten into the game fully as it should have. If Berdimuhamedov, for example, were to commit to that pipeline, I think the commercial interests would then get behind it. It makes sense for them to. The biggest oil companies in the world, for example, are working on the Kashagan oil field. There could be a combined pipeline, oil and natural gas. These companies, if they ever, Ed is snickering, and I'm guessing, will that field ever come online? Okay, but if it does come online, then which I think it eventually will, then these companies involved there, ExxonMobil, Shell, Eni, Total, these huge oil companies, do need a route in addition to Russia and this barge traffic to get that oil out. And one way of doing it would be the construction of a Trans-Caspian line, and I think they would get behind. This answers Ed's question too. What are the commercial interests that could get behind it? They would get behind it because it would be in their interest too.
But it seems to me you've identified why the commercial interests would be, because they have an upstream interest already, and that's what's missing in Turkmenistan right now. They're other than the Chinese. I don't know of a major project
deals
upstream in Turkmenistan that would cause a commercial champion to pop up to support a gas pipeline across the Caspian. Maybe that will come, but oil companies think of pipelines as cost centers, not as profit centers. And so unless there is a profit motivation upstream, it would be very hard to see why someone would want to pre-build a gas pipeline. Frank?
Thanks, Steve. This is really helpful. And I look forward to reading the book because we didn't have the benefit of going through all the documentation. And I don't know why I told you to shorten this presentation. A couple of points have been raised, and let me just kind of put some flesh on the bones. And going back to John's point and echoing some of the things that Rich has said, I think the contract of the century was important. And there was a position for the U.S. that we were 40% of the consortium. But the way that it evolved, we were in Pennzoil. Pennzoil was in Ganeshli. Amoco and BP were in Chirac and Azeri. We were unitized. And when the big field was unitized, the good news was it gave you a 6 billion barrel field to play with, right? The bad news was it was the largest consortium internationally ever. So we had 11 or 12 companies from 8 or 9 countries. And it was, to mitigate political risk, good idea. When you brought the commercial interests around the table, it was almost unmanageable, putting the Turks and the Russians and Delta Namir and BP and Statoil and the American companies. But I think that was a key element. I think SUPSA actually was the next big victory, because if SUPSA didn't happen, you wouldn't have had BTC. And then I would argue that there was a confluence or alignment, if you would, of political and commercial interests that made BTC happen. There are some folks in the government that say that it only happened because of either Aliyev or the U.S. government. And I would argue that on the commercial side, having sat through these negotiations, if it wasn't for the fact that BP and Amoco took 2 17% interests into 1 35% operating interest, and oh, by the way, they found gas, which actually helped, because prior to that time, BP wasn't all that interested in going through Turkey. And that was readily apparent when we made the subsa arguments, that now all of a sudden they had gas to move, and Turkey and Europe was a logical market. Better be nice to the Turks. We had the situation with the Bosphorus, and everyone recognized that a bypass was necessary. But I got to tell you, when you cost it out, expansion of SUPSA or Novorossiysk plus a $1 billion bypass, the price differential was $200 to $300 million on a $4 billion project. I mean, it wasn't noise in the system, but it wasn't a deal breaker at that point. And the idea of putting it in a pipeline, sending it to one spot, using the western side was really attractive. To me, the Caspian opening up, and I think there's still more oil there, and there's probably a lot of gas-prone areas. It was a major non-OPEC, non-Persian Gulf basin. And it was the last one, or the most recent one, that the industry internationally had seen in a long, long time. So the reason that all the multinationals went there is because it was a brand new basin that opened up. And the times were different. Rich's point is exactly right. When we were in the Gulistan Palace when the contract was signed, the contract of the century was signed, Lukoil was a participant specifically to bring Russia in so that they wouldn't block things. There was, I believe, a representative from the energy ministry in Russia that was there to witness the signing. While we were still in the palace, the foreign ministry issued this note, the first version of the note, that said, we don't recognize this. There is no such thing as the Azerbaijani sector of the Caspian. But which goes back to John's point about, okay, what can you learn? Facts on the ground are huge. When things start to happen, and we draw the parallels with Iraq all the time, if you make the investment, highly unlikely whether the central government can stop things in Kurdistan, but whether they would unwind contracts. You will find at some point that a model contract works and that the model contract can be reconciled with the contracts that are on the ground. So that's the kind of thing that goes forward. And the amount of time and the scope that it takes, I mean, the line fill in BTC, and this was at $50 oil prices, was $800 million. To fill the line. You start looking at a 1,500 mile or a 3,000 mile pipeline at $60 or $70, that's a sunk cost. That's line fill. You have to put that much oil plus one barrel to get one barrel off at the other end. And the same is true of gas. When you start looking at these long distance gas pipelines, this amount of line fill is just huge. And then you have to wonder whether LNG or other sources. So there's a lot of different dynamics at work. I would totally agree with Rich. I think the time in the 90s, Russia didn't have its act together, weren't as assertive, and probably missed the early game on the Caspian where things were going. The commercial interests and the government interests really worked closely together. And I don't know that that's able to be duplicated now because different things are going on. But for BTC, or the Trans-Caspian Gas Pipeline, I agree with Ed. I mean, unless short of the... and Turkmenistan can work together, that it may go forward. But we're in an entirely different situation. So while there is applicability and there are lessons, I think, that you can learn, you got to be careful that you don't just take the model and move it over.
Thank you. Tatiana Koprovich, Voice of America. If I may be allowed three questions. The first question, European Union has moved forward a proposal which limits non-European Union countries from buying power grids and power pipelines in the countries of EU membership, which actually limits Russian capabilities to buy these power grids, and it's pretty much aimed against Russia. So tomorrow going to be a meeting, European Union-Russian meeting in Lisbon. Question, is it the right thing to do? How would you assess this this proposal, which Russia, in words by Sergei Ostrozhensky, already named as discriminatory? The second question is, as a part of a big game which Russia plays and the United States trying to play in the region, how would you assess this element of gas pipeline which goes through the territory of Ukraine and Belarus and which supplies 80% of gas to Europe? What U.S. interests should be in the region? What are they now? And what are the possible ways to kind of end up this blackmail situations which is going on right now? And the third question is a sort of a personal question. Are you the friend of Pearl's family, which Miriam Pearl describes in her book?
Thank you very much. On the first question, you can use this word discriminatory. It is the proposal is written with Gazprom and Russia in mind. It's opposed by a couple of Western European countries, and it's not clear that it is going to be approved. I think it should be approved for the reasons that are stated. The entity creating the electricity or creating the power shouldn't control everything from one end to the other. And these are this is the law in the European Union, and it should be followed in this case. Just to add one more note, it also should be followed for the reasons that I stated, specific reasons that I really think that it is imprudent, specifically in Russia's case, which has a history of using energy power as a blunt instrument, to project this into Europe in this way. On Ukraine and Belarus, I don't know that the United States can get mixed up in this. The people stealing the gas, these are mafia types, and what are you going to do? This Dmitry Firtash, who is he, and who is he really involved with, and all that. On the third question, yes. Okay.
I have to not let this pass without some comment that it's really, I love the Russian sense of irony on saying that the EU proposals, and they are proposals, is discriminatory given what's going on in Russia, particularly in the upstream sector, and how projects are being identified as strategic assets and therefore not available for even bidding by foreign entities.
One country that we've sort of ignored but can't is Turkey in this discussion. And, again, going back to my period, the clarity of Turkish policy was evident in at least how, Baku, Tbilisi, Cheyenne ultimately worked out. What is your view of the role of Turkey as we're in, you know, this different situation today? Because, you know, we can talk all we want about whose gas goes where, but at least as far as I know, one way or another, Turkey's going to be part of this. I wondered what
your... It's not your grandfather's Turkey anymore.
Well...
That's right. Turkey, and of course, this is a point that one can't overstate, is the hub role that Turkey plays as the channel for all of this energy into Europe, and future channel. It simply can't be done without. And not just that's not a passive role. Turkey played active isn't enough to describe Turkey's role, Demirel's role in making the deals happen, the oil deals happen, and the pipeline deals happen, and I think it will continue in this role, and it will be this hub, this transportation hub into Europe. Keith?
A couple of questions. One, I was just in Brussels, and there was some speculation that, and I was interested to hear a European raise the issue of the Field of Dreams, you know, the movie, If You Build It, They'll Come, in reference to Nabucco, that the feeling is that if they push hard enough and they get the EBRD and others to finance Nabucco, the early gas comes from Azerbaijan, that there's a feeling in Brussels, among some people anyway, that the Kazakhs and maybe the Turkmen will see that the Europeans are serious about doing something which will confront the Russians and give them some kind of political protection, which then they will then put gas into those pipelines, whether it's a Trans-Caspian gas line. I suspect that's what the Europeans are hoping for. But their feel is that the Turkmen and the Kazakhs are waiting for something to be concretely built so they can have some protection in case they decide to go in that direction, political protection. The second question has to do with Nord Stream. Do you really think it'll ever be built? And that's a question that they're asking in Europe.
Thanks for those questions. I don't think that's realistic. Some may argue with that. I can't. If one builds Nabucco, that suddenly Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan are going to muster the courage to challenge Russia. They really need to go first. It's like building the arms before you build the torso, and it really needs to go the reverse. I think Nord Stream. I don't know why in Brussels they would say that it's not going to be built. I think it's going to be built. I think it is. Yeah.
Some of us said that Blue Stream would never be built or never should be built, but it got built anyway.
Another question, but this one is on Turkmenistan. In the good old days when Niyazov was around, somebody would walk into his office and say, I want to build a pipeline. And Niyazov would say, go to it. So you had pipelines on the maps going in all directions, north, east, south, and west. Now things have calmed down a bit with the change in power, but does Turkmenistan really have sufficient gas reserves to support the major pipelines that they'd like to build?
I think that it has, if you combine Turkmenistan's natural gas and the natural gas out of Tengiz and Kashagan, Karachaganak, Uzbekistan's natural gas. There is sufficient natural gas to support this pipeline. I think the bigger question is the one that Ed raised, will there be? Now, Chevron is poking around there. Maybe one of the big companies will step up to the plate and do one of these fields.
Well, just to add on your what you said about the torso and the arms and legs, which I didn't quite get, but one thing that's underestimated, at least in this town, is how long these projects take to mature. How long was the signing of the so-called contract of the century and first oil? And how long pipelines take to be for the deal to be put together, never mind build it. Building is probably by far the simplest thing to do, but put a deal, a pipeline deal together to financial close will take more than a couple of years easily. So, you know, first companies would have to have an upstream interest. They have to have a discovery. One of the advantages of Tengiz was that it was a discovered field. So you weren't taking exploration risks. You know the oil's there. It's just a matter of developing the production facilities. But if you're starting with a greenfield project in Turkmenistan, it'll be years. Kashagan is still looking for first oil. And Mr. Scaroni said 2010, but I'm not sure I would bet my house on it. Sometimes these projects take 7-10 years easily to mature to the point where you have something to move, or to a point where you know for sure you have sufficient volume to move make a long haul pipeline economically viable. So. It seems to me that was maybe another lesson from the 90s, was that it wasn't like, you know, they had one meeting at the NSC, some kind of a revelation and decided that, okay, we're going to support this, and tomorrow it happened. It took years and years and years of hard work on a lot of people's part, including, you know, some of the people in this room, before any of us thought that it was actually going to happen. It is a serious business that takes a lot of deliberate steps and a lot of building blocks before you get there. Appointing a former Dutch foreign minister to be coordinator in Nabucco may be nice, but probably not sufficient to make that project a reality.
Sorry, Lou. Turkmenistan is not totally greenfield. It does produce natural gas. There is the Dalatabad natural gas field, for example. So there is upstream there, and I think it really is the question of whether one of the companies has the interest to, and the Berdi Muhammedov has the interest to make that deal.
If we think the Russians are all powerful, they hold all the cards, it's just not true. I mean, they have a tremendous demographic problem. They've got a resurging Chinese in the east. They've got these Muslim populations in the south. I mean, in many ways, the Russians are quite vulnerable. And some of what they may be doing now is trying to gain some leverage. But even look at the gas contracts with the Chinese. The Chinese look at the prices and they say, sorry, they're too high. We're going to use coal. And there are limits to how far the Russians can push things. And so we need to have a policy that understands they face a risk profile as well, both commercially and politically. And when you sort of make these trade-offs, I think you have those calculations have to be in there.
Lou, yes, Russia does have a risk profile. And again, this is... another one of these matters, do we have to take that into account in terms of what we do? I think we take it into account in terms of understanding what are the strengths and weaknesses of another player. But again, I'm not sure that it changes the end game.
Let me ask a question about China. Should the United States be in favor of pipelines from Central Asia to China?
Are you asking me or the group? I think yes. Yes, absolutely. The China is a as I was saying earlier, a unspoken ally of U.S. best interest in Western best interests in that region. It's another buyer, diversification of demand for the region, and so I think the U.S. and the West should not get in the way of China building and building pipelines and buying.
I'm glad you opened the door, because I do have a follow-on question concerning China. You know, they're making a great move in all areas of Africa, particularly in the Congo and some other areas where there's supposedly proven sources of oil and natural gas, but yet undeveloped. What do you think the move of the United States and maybe Western Europe should be vis-a-vis these pipelines coming out of Central Asia into China? Would that take pressure off of these supplies in Africa and other areas? Or do you think we should allow China to continue to seek expansion on the African continent? And what do you think that should be vis-a-vis Central Asia?
I'm not sure that the U.S. has any leverage in terms of what deals China does around the world. This is part of the changing canvas for the major oil companies. The competition for resources around the world have made their future look different from today. Their profiles, their large profiles. I think their heyday still part of their heyday with their large profits, but they're headed for decline. The big oil companies of the future will be companies like the Chinese National Oil Company Gazprom, the national companies, and there simply isn't much to do. I just think that's just reality, I'm not sure that there's a link. China's energy hunger and thirst is so big. I don't know that if lines were built into Central Asia and Russia, that would change its thirst and the assertiveness of the Chinese companies in buying properties. And let me also say that one can argue that it's wrong or why should a subsidized company like the Chinese National Oil Company willing to pay any price? This is unfair. It's unfair to the major oil companies. Well, you know, this is the game that the major oil companies are in. But is that a dangerous thing geopolitically? This is a question I won't attempt to answer now. But at least today, I don't feel that China is the same kind of a political threat that Russia is. What is China going to do with this? It just wants the oil. Is China attempting to project political power out of China? I'm just not sure that it's doing that. Yeah.
I'm going to take the prerogative to ask the last question. One literal state that we haven't mentioned so far is Iran. You talked about the Tehran summit just a week ago or so. To what extent is a more active Iran in the Caspian game a factor that we need to consider in the future?
Iran has been active. It's been active in this axis. So Russia allies with Iran, and Iran allies with Russia in an attempt to exert power and really play a spoiler role. I think that this is going to continue. That Putin will continue to ally with Ahmadinejad on this question and on other questions. Interestingly, Bush said the other day publicly that he hopes that Putin uses that channel to influence Ahmadinejad. I'm not sure it's possible that he can, but that's if anybody can, perhaps he can, and that's a very interesting thing that I think we need to watch that relationship for the future.
Well, thank you very much, Steve, for this very rich presentation and discussion, and I hope we're going to sell a few books along the way.